He was a major force in 20th century music. Leonard Bernstein was one of America's leading composers of classical music and Broadway shows, and the longtime conductor of the New York Philharmonic, and a much-recorded pianist, among other things, an educator, too. As we observe 100 years of Leonard Bernstein, what can we discover about the music and the man? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. With me is John Demain, longtime conductor of the Madison Symphony, who has worked closely with Bernstein and conducted a lot of his music over the years, and I'm sure in the years to come we'll be conducting a lot more of it as we mark 100 years of Leonard Bernstein. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. Great to be here.
Leonard Bernstein really is one of those figures who bursts on the scene all of a sudden, it seems like, 1944 at the age of 26.
Right, the year I was born.
So you both burst onto the scene.
Now we know how old I am, but anyway.
Yeah. And so he is a Harvard-educated pianist up until that point, but there's obviously a lot of other things going on with Leonard Bernstein.
Right. I mean, what I found interesting is that he really didn't hear his first orchestral concert until he was 14 years old. His father was a Ukrainian immigrant, so you had that sort of Russian emigre thing that George Gershwin had, and you know, all the people that were involved with the creation of Porgy and Bess, and he met Aaron Copland at Harvard, and he said that Aaron Copland was his only real composition teacher. From there, he then went to study conducting and composition at the Curtis Institute, and that's where he studied with Fritz Reiner.
Eminent conductor, yeah.
Right, and I think Reiner said that that Leonard Bernstein was the only student he had that gave him an A. But
he was a tough guy, Reiner was.
Well, he was a very tough guy. You know, I remember the first time I met Lenny in 1971 in Tanglewood, when I had a fellowship there. And Lenny wasn't there that summer to teach the course, but he came in for a big weekend because he was guest conducting the symphony, and he wanted to hear us conduct, and so we conducted. The next day there was this master class, and I was just transitioning into being a classical conductor, and I had never and you know, the Tanglewood Festival Orchestra, the student orchestra, is gigantic because there's, you know, like eight flute players sitting in there in the room.
Have to get everybody in.
So I learned the Egmont Overture, and I get ready to conduct it, you know, and I don't know that – I didn't know I could go real tiny and get all those people play together. So I am just over-conducting to beat the band. You know, I'm gesticulating wildly in the air. And the next day we have this master class, and the first and I remember that Lenny was – absolutely clairvoyant with all of us. And he looked at me and he said, have you ever conducted an orchestra of this size before? And I said, no, actually, most of my work has been with smaller theater ensembles in the pit. He said, well, you reminded me of myself. And he said, when I was conducting in front of Reiner for the first time, he said, pardon the expression, but he said, I was Christ on the cross crucified. And Reiner, you know, tapped on the podium and told me to sit down. And he told me after I got over myself, I could conduct again. So, well, I don't think he ever got over himself, because we know that Lenny as a conductor was wildly gesticulating and you know, sweating and jumping off the podium and all those things. But and we asked him about that because, you know, I mean, he's actually, this is our time to be with him in this class. And he said, well, he said, I look at myself on television, he said, and I really don't like what I see at all the jumping around. But he said, I have to do that to get into the music. That's what I need to do. So that was his point. But so that, you know, Fritz Reiner relationship started. And then after that, at 20, he goes to to Tanglewood for the first time. And he begins his studies with Serge Koussevitzky. And that became such a successful relationship that eventually he became head of orchestral studies at Tanglewood in the summer, and had that long relationship in Tanglewood. So here we are now up to the age of 23, 1 year before I'm born, and that's the year that he is assisting, I think, Arthur Rozinski at the New York Philharmonic.
Another big conductor.
Another big conductor. And Bruno Walter was guest conducting, got the flu, fell ill. Mm-hmm. Bernstein jumped in, And the concert was broadcast live on the radio. So he
nationwide,
So he became an overnight sensation. And 1 year later, he led the premiere of his first symphony, his ballet Fancy Free, choreographed by the great Jerome Robbins. The music from Fancy Free would find its way, of course, into On the Town. And, of course, his first big Broadway hit, On the Town, at 26 years of age, year I was born. He is now a wunderkind, right? And absolutely amazing.
He was already a pianist when he was, I'll say, discovered by the likes of Dimitri Mitropoulos, I think. But they talk about a triple threat, performer, conductor, composer. And by the age of 26, he's already
doing all that. And then, of course, he adds educator and lecturer and all those other things, political activist, social activist, all those things. But I think that, I've been making a case in my own mind as I've been, getting older and thinking about Lenny and why, Lenny was so controversial and why he was... had a trouble being accepted as a composer and that he was always criticized by the critics as being too eclectic and wanting to do it all. And I've been trying to make a case that, Lenny saw himself as the heir apparent to George Gershwin.
Well, the timing was right.
Timing was absolutely right. So he's growing up when Gershwin is performing all this music. And we can talk about that as we go on, but his first jobs after he left school and he went back, he lived in Greenwich Village. He shared an apartment with Adolph Green and he was playing in clubs, jazz in clubs. So, he really was this young American musician, steeped in classical composition, steeped in classical conducting, playing jazz in clubs, and writing his first Broadway show. So,
starts to sound kind of like Gershwin there.
And it sounds a lot like Gershwin.
But does the music sound at all like Gershwin? I've never thought so.
Well, it's jazzy. Why don't we listen to a little of On the Town?
John, I'm trying to figure out who would have been the inspiration, what earlier composer would have been the inspiration for that, and I'm coming up blank. Is it a style that comes just totally from Bernstein himself, do you think?
Well, yeah. I think he's, he's playing jazz. I think that, his music is his own right from the beginning. I mean, I think there is something to a Bernstein sound. You know, I mean.
Oh, for sure. There is a sound,
you know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think, but there's no question that he was probably listening to a lot of different people at that point in time. I also thought, you know, but that success that he had with jumping in for Bruno Walter led to his guest conducting symphony orchestras all over the country, you know, as this wunderkind, and regularly with the New York Philharmonic. And I think that always on Lenny's mind was this transition from the European-based kind of classical music to America having its own voice and its own music and beginning to celebrate its own music and develop its own music through its American composers. And he was a champion of them. But he was looking for authenticity in the in what we would call an American composer. So, you know, so for example, we know that Dvorak comes over and meets Harry Burley and discovers the Negro spiritual, and he believes that in the music of the indigenous, you know, African American and living in America, that we have the source material for original American music.
Sure.
But the thing is that when he writes something like the New World Symphony, he may delve into that.
But it's Czech.
But it's Czech. He develops it in a very European way. Mm-hmm. And so that really is not the answer. That's not really an American sound. And Bernstein was rather outspoken about that. Where Ives, of course, Charles Ives, who was this insurance salesman with this incredibly gifted ability to write music, he delved right into the American folk music of Stephen Foster, you know, and the indigenous music of America, as Gershwin delved into the African-American themes and Broadway types melodies to create themes for classical composition.
So did Bernstein consider Ives the genuine article,
yes,
then in American
the real
music?
Genuine, so much so that he conducted, can you imagine, 50 years after Ives' death, Leonard Bernstein conducted the premiere of the Ives Second Symphony and recorded it with the New York Philharmonic. Now, you know, right after that, he composes his first opera, one act, Trouble in Tahiti, which is a romp about a dysfunctional marriage and
yes,
very, very successful.
And pretty funny, too.
And it became the jumping off point for his first full-length opera, which I conducted the world premiere of in 1983, A Quiet Place, which we'll get to later. But I was fascinated by Trouble in Tahiti, and it's a marvelous piece, and it's one that I think is done all the time. It is a perfect piece in a college situation, but it's played all the time, especially when you're looking for something to put on a double bill because it's,
yes,
only a one act.
Right.
Also in that time period, he wrote the Serenade and Plato Symposium for solo violin, which we have done with the Madison Symphony. Actually, a couple of years ago, Naha Greenholz soloed it. Some critics believe that's his finest classical composition. And then he was, by 1955, we have On the Waterfront. So he's
movie music.
Doing movie music. I read that he at one time wanted to do a movie. Did you know he wanted to do a movie with Greta Garbo in which he was going to play Tchaikovsky and she would play von Meck, you know, his
patroness.
But
wow, what an interesting idea.
I mean, talk about somebody who's voracious, who wanted to do it all, you know. I mean, he just couldn't get enough, you know. He was so in love with it. But now we move into, so he's guest conducting, and at the same time, he's writing, and he gives us his two most popular works, 1956 and 1957. In 1956 was Candide, and it was a pain to European operetta. It was his sort of send-up of European operetta, and I think it's a marvelously classical score in the sense of Fledermaus and Merry Widow, you know, of being,
yes,
you know, a classical operetta in which he brings to Broadway. And it was a problematic piece because the score was great, but they couldn't harness this huge book, you know, The Travels of Candide. You know,
right, of Voltaire.
And so Lillian Hellman was not successful with the book. But I think before we go forward, let's just hear a selection from Candide to just appreciate Lenny's comedic writing. And here we have one of the great opera singers of our generation, Christa Ludwig, singing The Old Lady, right? From and she's talking about how she is not easily assimilated.
By the time we get to Candide, we're seeing a man of many parts indeed.
Oh, I know. And I mean, that's just one aspect of a score that is so rich with invention, and not to mention the great overture that leads the whole thing off and that is actually quotes from the music that is actually in the operetta, and the great aria, Glitter and Be Gay. I'm doing Candide in October. It'll be my debut at the Teatro de Liceu in Barcelona.
Congratulations.
The great opera house. And thank you. And it's to celebrate Lenny's 100th. And we're going to do it in concert. But so there were many different versions that came out of, Hal Prince did one for Broadway. Mm-hmm. And then John Malcherry with the Scottish National Opera rediscovered all of the music that Lenny had written for Candide and found a way to, again, not really create a successful book show, but give us, in retrospect, an even greater look at the breadth of composition that was inside that show. So when I do it in Spain, I will be doing all of the big numbers that he wrote, and there will be a narrator, actually, who will walk us through the piece in Catalan, and then, of course, we will—
For that, I'm imagining.
Yeah, absolutely, and then we'll sing in English, and when the actors speak a little bit, a few lines of dialogue, that will be in English. But I think this is going to be—I have a great cast, but I think this will be a fun way to do it because we can just really focus on this amazing score, brilliant score.
Bernstein and Beethoven and Mahler, back with John Demain right after this. You're listening to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with John Demain, the conductor of the Madison Symphony, who has had direct experience with Leonard Bernstein and his music many times over. And having looked at the early years of Bernstein going into the early 1950s, by the time we get into the 50s, Bernstein is really, I think, associated for most people with conducting the big composers' works, you know, Beethoven and Mahler, and you know, the list is almost endless of the recordings that he started to make in those years.
Right, and by the way, he was already on television in these in Omnibus. You know,
sure,
he was
in the early 50s.
Lecturing and teaching. Literally teaching music to the American public via television, which was amazing. And then, of course, went on to the Young People's Concerts after became music director of the Philharmonic. So in looking at a bit of a chronology, can you imagine that you have this great score in 56, Candide, and then his most significant work and one of the great works of the 20th century, West Side Story. On any level, West Side Story is a great composition, and it opens in 1957. I remember, I conducted a revival in 1980, and we'll get to that a little later. But I do remember that Lenny telling me that when he wrote this piece, he conceived it as an opera. I mean, it was all sung, and he and the prologue, all that. When I had my first meeting with him at the Dakota apartments where he lived, he sang for me and played, you know, these lyrics, and he said it was Jerome Robbins who came into the picture and said, nobody's going to listen to all that. We're going to dance this, we're going to talk this, and we're going to sing that. And it was Robbins who actually fashioned the piece into a cohesive and great musical theater work. But of course, the score, Lenny gets big credit for. The next year, and I think this is another interesting thing that I ponder about, because the next year he's the first American to be named music director of the New York Philharmonic.
Took a little more while to get around to it, didn't it?
and the Philharmonic was in a bit of a disarray. I mean, it wasn't as a polished ensemble as some of the other orchestras, like the Philadelphia and Boston, and of course the European orchestras. And I think they maybe look towards Lenny to having, you know, to fixing that situation, but that's not really what was on his mind. I think for the next 10 years, he wanted to champion an American vocabulary. His first season, he was doing all American composers. So he's huge, making a huge statement. So you know that he knew that he was an American, having a chance to be on one of the biggest bully pulpits there is, you know.
And this is where he can become influential. I mean, it's one thing to be influential as a composer, and at times I had the impression from stories by Morton Gould and Aaron Copland even that he kind of oversold his own influence as a composer. But when it came to conducting, as you say, he had that bully pulpit to make known the work of other composers, and who was he championing at this point? I mean, people already knew about Beethoven and Mahler.
Well, Bernstein did that first season, you know, trying to passionately develop an American vocabulary, of American tradition of composers, at the same time conducting these big classics. It sort of lasted one season.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, but he never stop championing, you know, certain American composers. I mean, he loved Lucas Foss. He loved David Diamond, William Schumann.
Virgil Thompson.
Aaron Copland, of course, you know, was a big hero to him. And so all that music was happening all the time. But in 1960, we have the 100th, we have a centennial celebration of Gustav Mahler, who at one point was music director of the
New York Philharmonic. Yeah, around 1910 or 11.
And mm-hmm. I have to say, I have on my season next year the Mahler Symphony of 1000, Symphony No. 8. And I began my tenure here with the first Symphony of Mahler, the very first concert. And it was Lenny who made me aware of Mahler. You know, Lenny is a conductor.
Sure.
And everything he was doing at the New York Philharmonic. And it was during that time, because he became, you know, he was there from 58 to 68, and I started Juilliard in 1962, so he was right at the pinnacle of his time there. And he sort of owned New York and was just an incredible superstar, just an incredible everywhere he went.
Well, you know, multimedia, TV, radio, right. Concert hall,
and he'd done
composing,
this film score,
conducting.
And West Side Story alone.
Broadway.
I mean, my God.
He was everywhere.
So he was everywhere. But he had this love affair with Mahler. And it's interesting because, you know, when I was developing my own interpretations for my, because I've done all the Mahler, all nine since I've been here, I quickly realized that I would not want to emulate Lenny.
In what way?
Well, you know, as a conductor, he tended to be very exaggerated.
Right.
Especially as he got older. He got more ponderous. He got more heavy, highly theatrical. And I sort of figured that out because people were in awe of the set of Mahler symphonies that he had done. You know, that's okay if you're the average listener and you're putting it on. But when you got the score in front of you and you're trying to negotiate between what a conductor has done before you and what you want to do and what you think the composer has said.
There was a difference.
There's a big difference. Uh-huh. So, but what's important is not Lenny's interpretations of the Mahler symphonies, but he really is responsible for making us all aware of Mahler. And in many ways, Lenny thought he might be the great composer of the 20th century, placing him above Stravinsky.
Interesting, because Mahler, he died in 1911, so that's a tall order.
Right, certainly of the early 20th century, because he places him above Stravinsky in a way, because, you know, this 1 foot in the 19th century, but the roads that he was carving and the language and the stories that he was telling in a way with his music was simply colossal. And it really knocked me over when I first encountered, not to mention this Mahler third. I think that, he was, Alma Mahler heard him conduct at that time. And so 1960, I think, started his love affair with Mahler. The Mahler Third, of course, was a piece that he recorded and, of course, had a great association with. But I think it's also interesting to know that it was the piece that was played the day after Kennedy's assassination in 1963. And that was the first time, I believe, that a Mahler symphony was used in this way as a part of a memorial service for someone who, passed away, who was
a major figure. This is the finale of the Symphony No. 3 by Mahler as conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Thank you. Leonard Bernstein doing for Mahler what he did about the same time, also 50 years after the fact, for Charles Ives in some ways, you know, really right. bringing him into the mainstream, at least of the popular consciousness. And yeah, Mahler became almost a cult composer for a lot of people in the 60s and 70s
right,
and years
exactly.
following. And Bernstein, you're saying, gets the lion's share of the credit for that.
Right, and it was interesting because we know that he championed people like Copland and Schumann and David Diamond on the American side. But on the European side, not only did he champion Mahler, but he also, you know, his recording of the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony was legendary. And when they went to the Soviet Union, he played this piece in front of Shostakovich, and Shostakovich came up and took a bow on the stage. And Carl Nielsen, Sibelius. I mean, these were three people that were probably not played very much in American concert halls. And so he
certainly true, the Nielsen, yeah.
Yeah, so he championed those composers as well.
More about Leonard Bernstein and John Demain's insights into that conductor, composer, and multimedia personality when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with John Demain, and we're looking 100 years after his birth at the work in general of Leonard Bernstein as a composer, a conductor, a performer, a music educator, and really a big influence in music in general, both classical music and Broadway music, for that matter. And on the classical side, Leonard Bernstein wrote symphonies.
Right. I have mixed feelings about them, you know. I mean, I definitely in researching, and I wanted to do a significant classical composition of his this year to celebrate his 100th. And I felt of the three symphonies that The Age of Anxiety, for me, was by far the best. And it's really a piano concerto.
Right.
You know, it's almost like the Brahms second in a sense, because the Brahms second piano concerto is almost like a symphony.
That's right.
And so this is a symphony which is almost like a piano concerto.
And The Age of Anxiety, where does that come in?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know when he gave it that. I think he gave it that title during the 60s because of the times we were living in. And we're going to have Christopher Taylor play the piano part, which I think will be very, very exciting. And you know, my concert in November is Bernstein, the theater composer, and then Bernstein, the classical composer, and then Bernstein, the conductor. So now we get to hear a little bit of Age of Anxiety. Thank you.
Well, we have time for a couple more from Leonard Bernstein. And one of the components of his music, of course, certainly it makes sense in West Side Story, though, is kind of the Latin sound.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, he wrote this beautiful song, Maria. I'll never forget when we were doing the revival. This particular cha-cha that we're going to play from the symphonic dances, you know, Lenny didn't conduct the original Broadway score. Maurice Press did, you know. And this one night in previews, Lenny comes to me and he tells me to play this cha-cha, which you're going to hear now, at the tempo you're going to hear now, which is faster than it was in the original show. And he tells me to play it faster. And that night I go into the pit and I don't see Jerome Robbins before the show. We're in tryouts in Miami. And I thoughtlessly did not think of going to the actors and telling them that it was going to be a little faster tonight, you know, to the Maria and the Tony. And so I started and they actually trip on the stage and the curtain comes down at the end of Act One and Jerome Robbins comes tearing back, you know, to me, and he points his finger at me and he goes, "If Leonard Bernstein wants it that fast, I'll simply write it out of the show. Besides, who knows if he ever really wrote it?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well," he said, "you know, I would be with my dance rehearsal pianist in the rehearsal room." And I said, "What can you do with Maria?" And we would improvise and create, you know, dance music. And then I'm sure Lenny came in and, you know, sculpted it. Mm-hmm. You know, the composition. So he said, "I don't remember what Lenny did and what he didn't do." So anyway, I said, "Well, would you please talk to him tonight about it? Because I'm feeling caught in the middle here, you know." And so at the note session afterwards, they didn't want to talk about it, and I made them talk about it. They ended up singing it to each other in two different tempos and looking at each other at the end and saying, "Right." So they agreed to disagree, and the only thing that helped me get through this whole situation back in 1980 was when Leonard Bernstein came to me and said, "The only reason why we're doing this revival is because Jerome Robbins agreed to direct it, so give him what he wants." So why do we hear the cha-cha from the symphonic dances, which of course was created later? So that was, of course, 57. By now, we're already moved up because he's created the symphonic dances, recorded them, conducted them. But I think one other piece that might be misjudged and has begun to take its place among his major compositions is his Mass, which he wrote in 1971 for the opening of the Kennedy Center. And, it was an eclectic look at many different religions and many different popular forms of music today, you know, created into this massive oratorio, which is getting certain revivals this summer in Tanglewood, I believe, and the Mostly Mozart Festival is going to do it in New York. And so it'll be interesting to see how the piece holds up. And in its more recent outings, it's been highly praised. So that, after the West Side Story experience with Lenny, there was the Houston Grand Opera that decided to commission him and ask him to write an opera. And Lenny had long wanted to write a full-length opera. And he decided to use there's a moment when Dinah in Trouble in Tahiti, his one-act opera, is singing about her desire to go to a quiet place. And so that becomes the title of his first big opus. Now, I'll just say a little something about it. It was not well received. The New York Times critic, I think it was Donald Henahan at the time, called it a pretentious failure. Lenny, of course, was very sad about that because he really wanted it to be a great piece. But recently, a couple of years ago, it was revived at the New York City Opera and got wonderful reviews. And I remember, you know, I mean, it was a great time to work with Lenny, and he was very affirmative of my work on the piece, and we gave it a fantastic world premiere. There's nothing wrong with the production of the world premiere. The problem was that the libretto by Stephen Wadsworth often spoke in fragments, the unfinished sentences. And the advantage of the revival a couple of years ago at New York City, the old New York City Opera, not the new one, but the old one before it collapsed, the advantage of that was surtitles. I'll never forget, we did A Quiet Place in the final run-through in our warehouse rehearsal room where we were rehearsing, and we invited our major donors, and they were actually weeping and crying, and they were deeply moved by the piece. We move into Jones Hall, which is not even Wortham, which is the new opera house in Houston, but where the symphony still plays, the Jones Hall for the Performing Arts, which was some 3,000 seats. And we've got really what is an overblown chamber piece. And you can't understand the words, so you can't follow it. But the Houston Symphony is playing the score in the pit. They're in love with the music. The music's fabulous, and they love the score. So I was really glad that a couple of years ago when they revived it at City Opera, that people began to see what it was, because it's a fantastic documentation of life in the 1980s. Dysfunctional, you know, everybody running off to their psychiatrist, everybody having their problems. But it might be the only thing set to music from that period, you know, set to an opera.
From the orchestral suite based on the opera A Quiet Place, this is Sam's aria. Thank you. Sounds devilishly difficult to conduct with those tempo changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Fun. You know, he was so consumed with love for music. You know, I mean, it just poured out of every ounce of his body, his being. And because he was so intensely involved with music, when you worked with him, whether you were a performer or, you know, or conducting his piece or whatever it may be, he brought that to you. And I remember he could get amazing things out of people by sheer will, because his own commitment was so unswerving and just, you know, really, as I said, he was consumed with love for music. And he could do it in so many different ways, because he could play the piano and he could play jazz and he could write and he could conduct these incredible pieces and he could share his enthusiasm. And he shared his enthusiasm with, you know, a whole generation on television and actually taught people how to listen to classical music and taught composition in a way, the basic ideas of what intervals were, what sharps and flats were, what key signatures were, you know, and what was meant by different movements of pieces. And he gave all that. We've lost a lot of that today, you know, but we can actually buy the young people's concerts and we can go through them all for ourselves again. And
fortunately, he was prolific at recording things too, whether spoken word or music.
Yeah, so we have wonderful record of what he's given us.
Well, John Demain, thanks for giving us some insight into this giant of American music whose 100th anniversary we celebrate, Leonard Bernstein. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.